Broadcasting from the Civic Cypher Studios, welcome to the QR Code, where we share perspective, seek understanding, and shape outcomes. I'm your host, Ramses Ja.
He is your host. I just work here. My name is Q Ward.
And that's my guy. That's my brother right there. We want you to stick around because we have a lot to talk about. We always have a lot to talk about, but I think that this is going to be one of our more educational episodes. For the most part, we have a few things we want to discuss that have to do with how things look to us in terms of politics. So we're going to be asking, I think, a really important question. Would Jesus be a Republican? You know, obviously Christianity is associated very closely with the right, and we're going to examine that critically. We're also going to ask ourselves why certain foods are associated with racism. This is something that has come up recently in our world, and a lot of people don't know the origin stories of a lot of things like that, so we're going to get into the weeds there. Q's got a couple of stories he wants to share. One of them is on capitalism and sports and the intersection of those two elements. And then I think we're going to start off with something that we feel we should share with you, and that's kind of the origin story of this very show, sort of the primordial ooze, what prompted this, and hopefully give you a little bit more insight if you're just coming to the table, in terms of who we are and why we felt this was a pertinent and relevant addition to your airwaves and to, you know, your downloads, depending on which format you use to consume this content. So for longtime listeners, this might be a reintroduction, but for folks just coming to the table, this would be our introduction. But before we actually start, it is time, as always, for our feel-good feature. And today's feel-good feature comes from ThoughtCo.com. Black women are the most educated demographic in America. And my hope is that this flies in the face of those anti-DEI folks, those didn't earn it people and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, here we go. American women have had to fight for their right to an education. Well into the 20th century, women were discouraged from pursuing higher education as it was a popular notion that too much education would make a woman unfit for marriage. Women of color and poor women also experienced other structural impediments to their education for much of the nation's history that made it less likely for them to pursue education. However, times have certainly changed. In fact, since 1981, more women than men have been earning college degrees. Furthermore, these days, women outnumber men on many college campuses, making up 57% of college students. As a college professor at a large land-grant university, folks notice that many more women than men are in the classes. Things have also changed for women of color, particularly for those from historically underrepresented minorities. As legalized discrimination has given way to more opportunities, women of color have become more educated. While there is certainly room for improvement, Black, Latina, and Native American women are continuing to make their way onto college campuses in increasingly larger numbers. Indeed, some studies show that Black women are the most educated demographic in America. And I want to share a couple things with you just to take it away with you, because this does actually feel good. Black women earn more college degrees than any other race gender group in the United States. Despite their education, Black women earn less money than white men and face pay inequality. So people that are concerned about equality, the people that would don't like the equity in DEI and want that to be equality, they should also keep that same energy right here, where Black women earn less money than white men and face pay inequalities. And then finally, the quality of life for Black women is affected by low pay and health disparities. So food for thought. All right. Q, you are my brother. I mean, that feels a little thin because it feels like you're so much more than that. I guess I will start. I'm going to kind of fast forward through, you know, you and I getting to know each other and really get to the part where, you know, the show comes from and sort of the why. So Q and I, we met each other. You know, he moved to, you know, the city where I lived, and he was, you know, a popular person, and he was kind of doing his work thing or whatever. And I felt like, okay, well, you know, in Phoenix, there's not a lot of support. You know, there's not a lot of eyes on younger Black folks that are trying to do something. It's just not that way. It's too small of a city, and it's very conservative in their views. And so very clicky. And I was at a position where I was on the radio. I was kind of doing my thing. So everybody that I could help out, not just black men, but Latinas and Asian folks and people that weren't a part of the sort of the makeup that I saw kind of making everything work. If I was in a position to prop someone up, I did. And Q was no exception. So I was able to write a letter for his company where he worked. It was like a wine and spirits company. And just let them know, hey, this guy's out here doing a fantastic job on behalf of the radio station. We love working with him. We think he's great. We would only like to work with him moving forward. And, you know, thank you for your business, that sort of thing. And from that, a friendship formed. And we soon realized that it was more than a friendship because Q had a lot of talents that I felt could be developed if I took the time and just kind of poured into him and helped him to realize that. I'm sure you knew that you had a lot of talents too. Anyway, we're going through the fast version of the story, but we got to a point where, you know, Q became a DJ. We got to a point where Q got on the radio and helped me with a show. And then we got to the point where, you know, Q had his own ideas for shows because he was a more tenured broadcaster, and, you know, we developed programming together. Well, around the beginning parts of 2020, we ended up having to take a road trip. He had bought a car. It's important to the story. It was a Porsche. We bought a car in Florida, and he asked, "Hey, you want to come on this journey with me, and we can drive the car back together, so that way I don't have to drive by myself." Excuse me. And I'm like, "Okay, yeah, let's do it." We get to Florida, and you got to understand kind of the racial reckoning that was taking place and about to take place in the country. And, you know, two black men driving a fancy car back to, you know, across the length of the United States at that time was, I mean, I don't think that we really expected to run into any trouble on that journey, but we did. But before we ran into trouble, you know, Q kind of at that time started introducing me to podcasts. You know, I was a longtime broadcaster, and so I was just accustomed to radio. But Q would listen to sports podcasts and all kinds of stuff. And I began to see the appeal through your lens of podcasting. And then we had, you know, a lot of conversations on the plane ride there. You know, we stayed the night in a couple places, so we stayed up late talking about things. And, you know, again, with the backdrop of what was going on in the country, we recognized that there were a lot of things that people didn't know about what it meant to be black in America, what it meant to be from the hip hop culture. You know, people had a lot of prejudices and stereotypes. And at the time, we were in the Deep South, so we could see Confederate flags and billboards and all this sort of stuff that was decidedly racist. I wouldn't even give anyone the benefit of the doubt. They were intending to be very mean with a lot of the signage that was out at the time. And somehow or other, we felt like, hey, you know what? If we ever did a show, maybe we could do a show that really explained more in depth who we are, why these things make sense to us, and the appeal of the culture that we belong to us. You know, if we can explain why it appeals to us, and maybe people won't think that it's just another inferior culture. They'll start to see the value through our lens, so to speak, or something like that. I know you're going to jump in here, Q, and round it out, but the short version of the story is that that ended up becoming our kind of signature show, our widely syndicated program called Civic Cypher. And it was just an idea whose time had come. We were really focused on a lot of the more traumatic things that we were experiencing as a people, and the intersection of those traumas and politics. It just felt like, as broadcasters, there was nothing else really in that space, particularly on the type of stations that we were on, like hip hop stations and so forth at the time. And if no one else is talking about these things long form, no one else is giving allies insight or potential allies insight into the goings on in these communities, then how could they be informed enough to change the minds of their uncles and their, you know, watering coolers at the workplace and so forth, right? Their friends group that might not subscribe to kind of a shared reality here. So Civic Cypher was born as sort of the first step, the necessity. But the QR code was something that we felt could be sort of an everyman show. People that did not know that they could be allies, people that were not thinking about it in terms, there were people just simply seeking understanding. And we kind of arrived at that conclusion after a traumatic event on the trip. So I'll let you jump in here, Q, and you know, tell a little bit more of the story, pop in anything I might have left out.
Well, that's a very, very sweet and romantic version of the story. Ravis leaves out the part where he bullied and manipulated me into DJing and broadcasting.
Sure, sure.
Made it like it was some joint discovery where we, Q's got talent and let's do it. No, manipulated me into DJing. He left me in the DJ booth in a club live while the club was packed, act like he had to go to the bathroom and never came back. So, okay, I can't let this the music go off, so let's figure it out. Yeah. And then after 8 years of no, I don't want to talk on the radio, has me come in for a show idea. The show already had a producer and co-host and everything, but he tells me it's an idea, like we're going to do a rough draft. Nope, we're talking, it's on the radio. 2 days later or the next day or something crazy.
Sure.
And then George Floyd gave me my voice.
Yeah.
My passion about what happened to George Floyd gave me a reason to talk on the radio. That was just not my brother bullying me into something that I told him for 8 years in a row, three times a week, that I was not going to be able to do. So one day we'll tell a more accurate version of that story. It doesn't sound so sweet and magical. Ramses bullied and manipulated me into this life.
Yeah,
I didn't choose this path. It was
where you belong.
I mean, like Plymouth Rock. but, you know, wanting to kind of share our ideas outside of the traditional format of radio, where we're just playing music and talking for a few seconds before another commercial or another song. Our life experiences kind of, you know, put us on this path to activism, social justice, and civic engagement. A run-in with law enforcement in Mississippi at 3 o'clock in the morning where we'd done nothing wrong, but they decided that we did and we're going to try everything within their power to make that true. Getting on Facebook Live as that happened, Ramses's phone dying and scaring everyone that we know and love that was tuned into the live, thinking something really bad had happened to us. And I guess the fact is that something really bad could have happened. You know, Ram just said earlier that we didn't expect anything. I absolutely did. I was very aware that we were driving across the American South as a racial reckoning was happening. And as Ram just said, Confederate flags and radio shows and radio stations saying very inflammatory, directly racist things across FM radio stations that happened on that same trip. So we knew we had something in front of us. But as we listened to podcasts and had conversations, we also understood that outside of the kind of rigid, strict formatting of radio, there was a space where we could have long form conversations and engage with our audience in a different way. And even though my brother did not yet see the significance or the palpability of podcast and really saw them as far inferior to our radio show, with enough time and enough kind of audience engagement, we both learned that, you know, podcasting was something that we could do as well.
I kind of love that, man. Thank you for filling in those gaps. So, you know, that brings us to, you know, one of the bigger questions that we knew that we would discuss today. We had an interesting weekend. We spent the weekend in Detroit. And, you know, the question came up and we wanted to talk about it today. Would Jesus be a Republican? Now, the crazy thing is that there's a lot of folks who are religious conservatives, right? They are evangelicals. They are, who knows? And they have co-opted the idea and the figure of Jesus and the Bible and God to their side. their political side. And I have not found how they are able to justify that. And I see that they do, but they often ignore the shortcuts that they have to take or the intellectual dishonesty associated with the positions of the party that they vote for, right? And that at the same time, I have to bear in mind that, you know, I'm the benefit of the doubt person, so Q will probably correct me here. But these are often, if I had to guess, well-intentioned, well-meaning folks, right? So, like morally, it's tough to reconcile those two things. Now, Q, I see your face, and I know you're going to jump in. I will say this, that it was Christian people that enslaved us and our ancestors, you know, us meaning black people, not me and Q, literally, of course. And they used the Bible to justify that. They used Jesus to justify. They used all that to justify it, right? So morality only exists insofar as, you know, their interpretation of the Bible for their purposes, you know, exists, you know. But I'm sure there were people back then that when they went home at night, they felt good about themselves. They had found a justification for what it is they were doing, how they felt, and they picked out the parts of the Bible that worked, right? In order to help them kind of stand on that moral ground, if you will. But if an alien came from another planet that had no idea who Jesus was, or Republicans or Democrats or black people, or white people, none of that stuff, right? It was of no significance to them. And an alien was to learn about Jesus, Christianity. And you ask this alien, okay, does Jesus belong to this political party or to that political party? I would imagine that the alien would say, well, clearly, this alien belongs to the Democratic political party because this is the party of X, Y, and Z. And I'll make the X, Y, Z live, and then Q, you jump in here. Okay, so I'm going to read stuff from the Bible. This isn't, you know, this isn't journalistically credible sources. This isn't, you know, I've done the research. No, this is from the Bible, the actual Bible. Heal the sick who are there and tell them the kingdom of God has come near to you. Luke 10:9. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within your land that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother. Deuteronomy 15:7. Where there is no vision, the people perish. But happy is he who keeps the law. Proverbs 29:18. No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Matthew 6:24. It's for the fiscal conservatives. Do not oppress a foreigner. You yourselves know how it feels to be foreigners, because you were foreign in Egypt. Exodus 23:9. Big shout out to Southern California one time. And that's, you know, that's me talking. Q, I know that, you know, and by the way, my father was a minister. He's passed, so was a minister. Q's mother is a minister. We just saw her over the weekend. So, Q, your thoughts?
Oof. This is one of those things that for you and I has always cut really, really deep because of our backgrounds and our upbringing. You know, the sons of pastors, ministers, and spending 6 days a week in church as children and being very, very studied on the book
that way.
But it doesn't just cut deep with us. It should cut deep into the heart of American identity. And when you talk about politics and power, the right does appear to own Christianity. And trying to break it down, the disconnect is so obvious because Jesus was radically compassionate. Like, seek out and help everyone that has less than you and make a way for them and all of this. And the right is extremely the opposite of that. mm-hmm. while claiming loudly to follow Jesus, right? So, you know, there's the deliberate branding that we saw the right do. And I think they took advantage of their own language, right? The separation of church and state was once a thing. Mm-hmm. So progressive liberal people separated church and state. So since they separated, the church was just there for someone else to own it. Okay, since you guys have separated yourselves, separate church and state, we'll combine church and state and use it as a marketing gimmick to persuade people to vote for us. Mm. So proudly and loudly proclaiming Jesus in the church while making decisions that are very obviously anti-Jesus, well, they're the ones saying Jesus out loud, so we're just going to go with them, right? And then they use that power of religion, because religion is a faith-based thing. It is not a purely science or logic-based thing, so you didn't have to use statistics to justify those beliefs or those decisions. So if you want to stoke fear about gay rights or abortions or a woman's autonomy or immigration or racial equality, we're defending Christian America against moral decay, right? You position it that way, and then a Christian feels compelled to follow you. So it's less about scripture and becomes more about, you know, maintaining control,
yeah.
Right? White Christian nationalisms just call themselves Christianity, even That's though crazy. That they say out loud is about Jesus or his teachings, right? They just defend whiteness and patriarchy and power. So it's like, you know, the brown-skinned Jesus who flipped tables in the temple, they've replaced him with a white man and somehow combined him with guns.
So watch this.
It's a really strange marriage happening in front of us. Mm-hmm. And the left is kind of silent about it, because, again, the left has really hung on to the idea of the separation of church and state and being just Christians in action, right? If one person may be hungry over there, let's feed everyone mm-hmm. in action, like Jesus would have done, while the right does the exact opposite. But when they speak out loud, we're the evangelicals, we're the Christians, we're saving America from world decay and from all these groups that they've othered and made the enemy of Christianity.
So I want to make that part that you said live, you know, when you said the right does the opposite. The right says, if one of those people over there isn't actually hungry and they might be taking advantage of this, then let's shunt the whole program.
Yeah.
Don't feed anybody, because they might, one of those folks might take advantage. Yeah, I get that. That feels very thin when it butts up against, you know, their religious identity or what it should be, right? Gandhi famously said, I like your Christ, I don't like your Christians. They are so unlike your Christ, right?
It makes all the sense in the world, man. So, Jesus says, love your neighbor. The right says, build that wall.
Crazy, crazy.
Greatest thing ever, man.
So dig this. There are folks who, so let's say a vote means your wish of how the world you want to be, right? The world you want to live in. We're in agreement that all racists, all Ku Klux Klansmen, all Nazis, they all vote one way because that's the world they want to live in, right? All Republicans are in line with those folks, voting that same way. And if that moral conundrum isn't enough, what we're talking about now suggests that those people all think that Jesus would also be in that line because Jesus wants that same world. And that's the part that no one can say anything back to me that is meaningful or justifies that at all. And it's just heartbreaking. Now, I don't mean to just beat up on one group. I don't really mean to beat up on any groups, to be honest with you, but there's a lot that we need to talk about. And as I mentioned, this is going to be a show where we're, you know, fleshing out some conversations that we had over the weekend. So, Cubans better do better. Now, I want to say a couple things before I get into these weeds. First thing, I am part Cuban. Okay. In the studio here, I have the Cuban flag, you know, on Puerto Rican Day parades, I'll put on a Cuban shirt and go out and hang out with folks. But I'll be very honest. I don't live the life of a Cuban person, right? I knew a little bit of stuff from a long time ago from my grandma, and that's really it. But I would not be here if it weren't for Cuban people. Okay. And that gives me a little bit of grounds to say a little bit. So I'm going to say a little bit because I've regarded Cuban people in my heart a certain way that I think only you can only do that if you have like a biological ties to the island. Okay. And, you know, for Cuban people, the election, which turned, and it's not just this past election, going back, all the way back, you know, the ICE raids that were happening under every administration, you know, these are things that don't really hit Cubans who are largely based in, you know, Florida and, you know, the Southeast. The same way that it might hit other Latinos, however, they're all grouped inside of the same group, right? Even though they're different cultures, they just kind of have a common language and were conquered by Spain, I suppose. They have a common history, at least in that regard. So I'm going to share a little bit from cybercuba.com. Before I get there, this is just a little fun fact to help you frame this conversation. So there are almost 38.5 million Mexican Americans, over 5.5 million Puerto Ricans, and 2.6 million Cuban Americans in the mainland United States. Okay. So 2.6 million Cubans, almost twice as much Puerto Ricans, and 38.5 million Mexican Americans. Okay. Now, I'll read from cybercuba.com. According to electoral data and surveys conducted after the 2024 elections, Cuban Americans voted 58% for Trump, while only 40% supported Harris. Now, there's some polls that suggested it was a little higher, but this appears to be the most accurate. So we're going with that. All right. In the recent elections in the United States, Cuban American voters emerged as the only Hispanic demographic group that showed majority support for Donald Trump, while the rest of the Latino groups largely supported Kamala Harris. This pattern has been observed before, but this figure highlights the persistence of a political preference among Cuban Americans that distinguishes them from other Latin American groups, as reported on social media by the conservative platform AF Post. Mexicans and Puerto Ricans showed significant support for the Democratic candidate. Among voters of Mexican descent, Harris received 62% of support compared to 33% for Trump, while Puerto Ricans leaned 59% toward Harris and 37% to Trump. Other Hispanic groups, including those from Central and South America, also largely aligned with Harris. Cuban Americans represent a minority within the Hispanic population of the United States, with 2.6 million individuals, which accounts for less than 1% of the country's total population. Okay. So not necessarily the numbers, although there's an argument that a lot of that the voter turnout rate is slightly higher than Latinos in general when it comes to Cubans. There's slightly higher when it comes to Republicans relative to Democrats as well. But it's really the percentage here. And do you remember Q seeing all those concerts that took place about, you know, the Donald Trump, the Latinos for Trump, all that sort of stuff? A lot of that stuff took place in Miami,
mm-hmm.
and in Florida. And those were Cuban people behind those efforts, right?
Yes, sir.
And I think that, because I don't want to say to Cuban people, you know, you better do better for my sake. Okay. Because again, I don't live the life of a Cuban person. I would not profess to, you know, I just kind of have a slight connection to the community. So I pay attention when I see the word Cuban. I notice when I see the flag out in the real world, right? But I think that there is a disconnect, perhaps, with how Cubans regard themselves, even among Latinos. It might be the case that Cuban people feel less Latino than, let's say, Mexican people. They've distanced themselves from Cubanness. They've kept the name and the flag and parts of the culture, but, you know, the history and the roots of where they come from, I think there might be a distancing that has taken place there. And to be fair, some people might not have loved, you know, communism, socialism, whatever, might not have loved Castro or whatever the leadership looked like on the island. People have probably heard horror stories, etc. But in this land, their votes affect Latinos in ways that maybe they have not considered. And I think that just kind of the climate of the country compels me to ask my Cuban brothers and sisters to pay attention and maybe even do a little bit better.